Суд приговорил Навального Алексея Анатольевича признать.
Алексей Навальный получает 5 лет тюрьмы, а Петр офицер получает.
Позор! Позор!
Освободить Навального и офицера из постражи в зале суда.
Офицерова. Оба отпущены под подписку о невыезде. До
вступления... Я очень благодарю всех людей. Хотел бы, избирательная кампания будет продолжаться, поскольку это наше общение с избирателями.
After months of speculation about the fate of anti-corruption blogger and opposition leader Alexei Navalny, it looked like the Kremlin decided to show its teeth. Or at least it did at first. In a courtroom in the city of Kirov on Thursday, Judge Sergei Blinov sentenced Navalny to 5 years in prison on embezzlement charges widely viewed as trumped up. Navalny was immediately handcuffed and taken into custody, ending speculation that he might get a suspended sentence and apparently ending his run in Moscow's mayoral elections. So the Kremlin decided to play tough. Or did it? It wasn't long before cracks began to appear in the monolith. As thousands braved police cordons and took to the streets in protest in Moscow and elsewhere, the prosecutor general's office announced that it was, in fact, illegal to detain Navalny in court and that he should be free on bail pending appeal. And this morning, that is exactly what happened.
I would like to thank and hug all those people who have in any way helped this happen. I also want to thank my defense team. We understand that this is a very strange situation. At one moment, everybody is sad, then everybody is happy, and possibly the time will come everybody will be sad again. Nevertheless, if we have at least an extra couple of months to fight, we will fight.
The Navalny saga has reached a critical juncture. But does the Kremlin even have a strategy? Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me in Prague is co-host Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University and expert in Russia's security services and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, Brian.
And joining us on the Skype line from London is co-host Kirill Coburn of RFERL's Russian service and a contributor to the online magazine PolitRU. Welcome back, Kirill.
Hello.
And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Welcome back, Sean. Good to have you back.
It's good to be back. Thanks.
My thoughts as things developed over these past very strange 2 days were as follows. If you're the Kremlin and you want to go for broke with somebody of the magnitude of Navalny and put him away, you decide to do it, and you do it right. You get your ducks in a row, and you don't look back. But this whole thing appears improvised, half-baked, and a bit half-assed, if I may. As I pointed out in the blog recently, the trial itself already pushed the limits of the absurd in so many ways. 33 of the 35 prosecution witnesses testified actually in Navalny's favor. No profit was made from the alleged illegal transaction in which Navalny is purported to have made to embezzle 16 million rubles. And the document that was supposed to show he embezzled these 6 million mythical rubles only added up to 14 million. I mean, damn, they couldn't even get the math right. And after the conviction, sentencing, and very dramatic detention of Navalny in court yesterday, they let him go the next day, at least for now. And Navalny being Navalny, he didn't pass up the opportunity to squeeze in a joke about the whole thing during the court proceedings today. I want to quote Navalny. Quote, he said, "Esteemed court, first of all, I'd like to bring to your attention the need to ascertain the identity of prosecutor Sergei Bogdanov, because there is a chance that this is a double sent by members of the opposition, because it was the same prosecutor Bogdanov who yesterday demanded my detention in court." Mark, you wrote on Twitter today, I love this tweet, you wrote, these clowns can't even properly organize a show trial. What gives here?
It is pretty bizarre. I mean, in some ways, I draw the parallel with riot police. It's a pretty good way of sort of thinking about how, if you want to manage an Amon state, there's three basic characteristics that you need to demonstrate if you want to control a crowd. First of all, you need to have unity and discipline. That's what makes a a difference between a phalanx and a mob. You need to know exactly what the plan is, and everyone does it. If you're holding the line, you're holding the line. If you're pushing forward, you're pushing forward together. Secondly, you need to make sure that you control momentum. That's the big thing that actually makes a crowd of people be able to beat your riot police, if they can build up momentum. So you have to keep it and you have to control theirs. The third element is that you have to look formidable, unassailable. You really want to deter them from messing with you. I mean, that's one of the reasons why these cosmonauts, these riot armored cops, are all in black rather than lavender. It's precisely so they look so badass that no one's going to mess with them. Now, if we look at those three characteristics, I mean, it's extraordinary how the Kremlin has managed to fail on all three. Unity and discipline. The verdict seems to have been sort of pretty much put out at the last minute because there was no prior signalling. So one assumes that it was a sort of the result of a decision based on the night
before.
Bogdanov
looked nervous as he was reading it. I mean, his voice was visibly shaking, and he was speed reading. As I tweeted yesterday, it reminded me of that Federal Express commercial from the 70s. Remember, Peter, can I call you Pete? Remember, I don't know if you remember that, but go ahead.
So basically that, and you know, likewise, we now see what looks like a disagreement between the Investigations Committee and the General Procuracy and so forth. So they haven't got unity and discipline. They've given the opposition the momentum. Okay, so Navalny may only be out for a brief period of time, but nonetheless, you know, he's now able to present himself as the victorious one. He has a big charge from this that'll be a great boon to them. And in terms of looking formidable and unassailable, I mean, come on, give me a break. Exactly, they couldn't even manage a sort of a persecution by prosecution, and they allowed Navalny to basically claim that people coming out on the streets can make the Kremlin back down and change its mind. I don't believe that for a minute. I think it's because of internal processes, but that doesn't matter. The narrative he can give is that actually, you know, less than 10,000 people on the streets can make the Kremlin change. That's a really powerful sort of mimetic weapon to put in his hands.
That's a very succinct way to sum it up, and it's a good way to get the ball rolling. I mean, to take your three principles there, it was Navalny's people who looked unified and disciplined. They are the ones that have momentum. I'm not sure if they look as formidable as black-clad riot police right now, but those people climbing up on the state Duma yesterday, that was a powerful, powerful image. And I could not help but be reminded of last week what we discussed in this podcast about the incident where Navalny was detained right after he registered as a candidate for Moscow. The crowd surrounded the bus and they let him go. The same thing happened again. I mean, just in a much more dramatic and with the stakes, of course, much, much higher. But we said at the time this was a metaphor for the whole thing. And then they went ahead and gave us a bigger metaphor this week. Sean, what do you think? You just got back from Russia. So you got a pretty good, as did Kirill. You have a pretty good angle on this. What's your take?
Well, it's always interesting when I always find it interesting when I'm in country and how daily life kind of diverges from what I read in the media all the time. But amongst the people I was around, and most of them were academics and university students, the Navalny trial was certainly an issue that they were concerned about. We didn't talk too much about it directly, but there was an indication that everyone was figuring he would be he would be convicted. And one human rights lawyer I talked about said they would give him 4 years to seem liberal. Well, it seems that he was a bit wrong there. But nonetheless, I mean, amongst the university people I talked to, they definitely were not pro the government. And I even talked to one professor who has really good connections with Alexei Kudrin. And he didn't mince any words about his feelings about what the state was. I mean, he told me at one point that everyone in the government operates through cell phones. Nobody, there are no institutions. It's just direct calling to whoever you need to call. And he told me that he engaged in some of this too to get issues squashed in the university. Mm-hmm. But in terms of Navalny, it's clear it's coming out now that by some of the analyses as to why was he given such a harsh sentence? And then why did the prosecutor do this unprecedented action to appeal to have him released? And then now today his release. What is going on here? And from the Gazeta article that you sent out, and there was also an article today in Forbes, is that there seems to be a split mm-hmm. as to what to do with him and what to do with the opposition in general. The Gazeta article spoke about a party of tightening the screws and a party of political maneuvering. Mm-hmm. Tightening the screws more associated with the kind of Siloviki temperament within the Kremlin that just wants to suppress the opposition. And then there's a group of people seem to be connected to Subianin, who it seems to be coming out that he needs and wants legitimate elections in Moscow. And possibly Vyacheslav Volodin, who said a few weeks, 2 weeks ago, I think, that there should be political competition and the opposition should be allowed into the political game. They seem to want Navalny. There seems to be elements within the Kremlin elite that wanted a soft sentence, if not even no sentence, to allow Navalny to participate in the elections. So the maneuvering that's going on over the last 24 hours seems to be indicative of that. And I think some the softer line people that want political participation on the part of the opposition seem to realize that they need the opposition. They need them as a to be close enough, but certainly far enough to be able to create some dynamism within the political process. And since they can't get that certainly from, say, the Communist Party or Just Russia, they have to go outside standard political system to get some energy.
Gee, I seem to remember Surkov making that in an argument he lost back in 2011. And good God, are we talking about Volodin as a liberal? Is this how much things have degraded? It's interesting you mentioned Kudrin, and then we'll definitely get back to Volodin. It's interesting you mentioned Kudrin because he was out there with a tweet like it was like right after the verdict and one after another about how this is an example of selective justice in Russia. What they did to Navalny, they can do to any bureaucrat who had any contact with any businessman, and that this was an attempt to exclude him from public life. I mean, Kudrin didn't mince words. And again, this is still a man that has Putin's ear. You wanted to make another point?
Yeah, it seems that, you know, to speak about Volodin as a Kremlin liberal is actually interesting considering his first actions as within the presidential administration. But perhaps, you know, seeing the way things are going, that they do need some – they've kind of come to a stagnant halt politically and with elections seem to be those periods of kind of political contest within the Kremlin elite, that here is an opening that they need to figure out. Various factions split up and they try to push their agenda forward. And the Moscow election being the most important election in the country after the presidency seems to be one of those areas.
Yeah. Kirill, you got back from Russia yourself. Your thoughts on what's going on right now in this incredibly bizarre and developing case?
First of all, I'd like to say that it's not, you know, a crack in the state or in government in Russia. It's a long process of, sustainable decline. And we see just several signs of very interesting signs of this decline. By the way, this mistake in the math, 14 million instead of 16 million, that's another sign of a decline of, you know, judicial culture and even an education.
I thought Soviet mathematics education was like second to none.
Absolutely. And that is a very symbolic thing. By the way, it's not, you know, such funny as we think about this. Speaking seriously, it's a very interesting time from, you know, the beginning of this year when Kremlin made and still making one very serious mistake after another. Let's, you know, just focus on the previous scandal around, you know, a very quick move by Kremlin. It's a scandal around the academy, yes, Russian academy and so on. That was so swift. That was, you know, like a secret operation against enemies and so
on. You're speaking
on.
About the reform of the academy.
Yes,
of
yes, yes, yeah. yes. And all the science, you know, community, yeah, academic community was absolutely, you know, against it. And it's not just about politics again, or for Putin or against Putin or something like this. That was, you know, a sort of, I'm very sorry for this strong word, it was against the idiocy of this move because it was not about the reform and so on.
But it fits into a larger pattern where you tend to see this faction that wants greater control over everything in this faction that kind of, I would guess say, for lack of a better term, understands reality.
Yes, and we discussed a lot about this lack of understanding the political, social, and economic reality inside Kremlin. And now we see all these signs of this misunderstanding, of this illiteracy, you know, in politics, in all the issues in modern Russia. And it's very interesting. If we see, even, you know, you just mentioned that Kremlin, Volodin just tried to flirt with some opposition, not opposition, but mild, moderate opposition person, people, and try to explain itself that we need, you know, a competition on the elections and so on.
Well, if you also look at the comments that leaked out of his meeting with the Kremlin's kind of political team, they suggested this. These were where the comments about Navalny came out, but there was a lot of this. He sounded positively Surkovian almost. And you have to wonder, and I have to wonder, whether anybody sitting in Volodin's chair in the Kremlin is eventually, even if they come in a hardliner, is going to have to come back to this reality because of where Russian society is right now.
He just knows more than, you know, Putin himself or, you know, Sechin himself and so on. Bastrykin even. Bastrykin, you think Bastrykin knows everything.
No, yes? No, I don't. I was going to say it's not too hard to know more than Bastrykin, but
But anyway, it's interesting. It's like the situation in the beginning of 1980s in Soviet authorities and inside the Brezhnev circle and so on. Who knew better about the situation in USSR? KGB.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And KGB was, you know, one of the first, you know, sources of the reforms which, you know, eventually led to perestroika and so on. The problem of knowledge are very important, ever very important in a Russian state, in a Russian government. And we see another one important and very interesting, you know, sign of this thing. But the question is, are the failures of the regime, the serial mistakes made by Kremlin from the beginning of this year, are there, you know, the victories of Russian opposition? And that is the most interesting question.
Well, I think it's moved. That is an interesting question. And I would answer yes and no to that, because I'm reminded of a piece I read back when Volodin was really gathering his power after he managed to oust Surkov. It was a piece in, Gazeta.ru really does these good behind the scenes pieces, and they did on the Navalny case today, for example. But they had this piece about Surkov's people in kind of quasi exile, and the gist of the piece was that they basically understand that this isn't going to work because they've already been here. Right? And they're just waiting for it to run its course. And this is where I want to bring us now, is this, like, have we reached a watershed here with Navalny where this has, I don't want to say it's run its course, but as I said in the podcast in closing last week, I mean, the Navalny kind of crystallized, the Navalny and the Navalny case kind of crystallize a lot of the conflicts you're having in Russia right now. The obvious one between having a centralized controlled system and one that's a little bit looser and more pluralistic, but also the clash of the generations. I mean, he is emblematic of a new generation. The man was born in 76, right? He is the leader of the new generation in a lot of ways. Have we reached that watershed point, Mark?
I think we have. I think what is becoming clear, to be honest, is that the Kremlin doesn't realize that. Or I'm using Kremlin for the general elite. Volodin, yes, of course, someone like him would inevitably have to sort of come to a political judgment. Because I think this is we're at a point where there's a fairly stark binary choice. Either you take a political route, which will inevitably basically mean the fragmentation and eventual dissolution of this regime, but on the other hand, can do so potentially in a controlled, reasonable way in which people aren't being hung from lampposts and such like. Or you have the military option. Now, if Volodin ever goes there, essentially he is handing all the power and all the options at his disposal to the Bastrykins. So anyway,
who is not trusted by many people in the
precisely. Elite. I mean, so in any case, I mean, Volodin has a very sort of personal reason to want to maintain this issue. But the point is that if we look at those two options, what is clear to me is that the Putinism is dying. I mean, we're really just talking about the nature of the end game and the time frame. It can be 2 years, it could theoretically even be 10 years. But the point is, in that respect, either you try and sort of negotiate your way out, or if you're going to take the military option, the coercive option, I mean, again, go back to this point that I made at the beginning, you have to do it properly. And that means, and certainly I'm not advocating this, but it means actually being rigorous, ruthless, and unified.
Right, it's meaning ready to go Tiananmen on them.
Yeah, drawing another parallel from the 90s, but actually right at the end of the 90s, the 80s, Gorbachev's brief dalliance with the hardliners, mm-hmm. really over the winter of 1990 to 1991, in which, I mean, it says good things about his moral character that he then backed away from them mm-hmm. after the big protests in support of Yeltsin, because he realized that he was essentially putting himself mm-hmm. in the hands of nasty people who are going to take the Soviet Union.
Who eventually tried to overthrow him.
But the point is, again, that's a classic example of this belief that you can somehow manage coercion and keep it under political control. It's not going to happen. Either you go all out and you'd be willing to, yes, if need be, kill people, but for the moment just lock people up, but above all maintain ruthless discipline. Or you accept you're aiming for some kind of political option. Mm-hmm. At the moment, the Kremlin seems to want to have it every way and doesn't really know what it wants to do. It wants to be able to crack the whip, but then it then wants to be nice and it wants to be loved still, and it hopes mm-hmm. that somehow it can, you know, like a sort of abusive spouse that beats you today but hopes that by bringing you a bunch of flowers tomorrow, everything can be made all right. Mm-hmm. Well, that clearly is just not a sustainable approach. But the point is, no one has an idea. No one is willing to adopt one route or the other, or the people who are the Bastrykins of this world that are fortunately not right. deciding policy, finally. Or they're still hoping they can somehow create some sort of muddy mix of the two.
Well, Putin is the ultimate decider, right?
And but what he's not deciding.
He's not. Well, this is my point. Putin is trying to muddle through. And right now, you spelled out these two options. What I didn't hear you say is muddle through, right? I hear you go the military option, so to speak, or you go the negotiated transformation option. Muddling through where Russian society appears to be right now does not appear to be an option. And that's exactly what they're trying to do. Now, if you're Navalny in this situation, and I'm more and more every day convinced that he is becoming the key figure. I don't even want to talk about the opposition anymore. It's not about that anymore. It's about basically what kind of momentum Navalny can create right now. Sean, if you're Navalny, what are you looking to do right now? Are you looking to negotiate the end of this regime, or are you looking to knock it down, hopefully? Because the thing about Navalny, and people keep asking me, is can he win the Moscow mayor's election? I say, no, I don't think so. But it doesn't matter. Because for Navalny, it's not about winning an election inside the Putin system. It's about chipping away this monolith and building up your credibility, your street cred and everything until you are the alternative to this. And when it inevitably falls, you're the one standing there to pick up the pieces. What do you do if you're Navalny in this situation?
Well, first you try to stay out of jail. That's the obvious one.
But he's been pretty good at that the last 2 weeks, since the last two podcasts were discussing him getting out of jail.
Right. So he's certainly making progress on that front. But it's clear that he is, and they've kind of handed him a means to boost all of these things. The question is, and you guys talked about this last week repeatedly, is can he move outside his circle? Can he move outside the supporters that he has? And that remains to be seen. And I think that this is where you have to, you know, how we speak about the collective Putin. I think he needs to develop a collective Navalny. And I think this is something that I'd actually reserve comments for the second half of the podcast on the need to do that. But I actually want to go back to something that Mark brought up and something that we haven't even mentioned. I mean, Mark was the first person to mention Putin, but Putin, we haven't been talking about him.
We've gone 14 minutes into this podcast by my count, maybe 15 minutes and 39 seconds, and we have not mentioned Putin. That may be a record.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because in all of the articles that I've been looking at, his name is also absent.
No, this is what I mean. Navalny's at center stage right now, and they put him there.
Navalny's at center stage, but there are also a lot of other players who are now mentioned. I mean, Slobyanin is mentioned, obviously. Volodin is coming in. The way the system is operating, at least on the kind of politics of it, is operating below Putin. I mean, Putin, as Mark said, hasn't made a – we don't know what he's thinking.
He's trying to muddle through in my – I mean, that's the best I can discern.
I mean, I think you're right about that. I think he is trying to muddle through, or he just doesn't trust the information he's getting from the people around him to make a decision. And
he
that's
looks
another option.
Isolated, which reminds me of a lot of different historical – there's many historical parallels.
Certainly. And so he doesn't seem to be, at least, and when he is referred to, I think he's referred to as more of a symbol. So like mm-hmm. Putin has decided X. It's not really Putin as the person. It's Putin as a symbol for the power structure. So I think that's an interesting thing to think about, is that where does the guy, the head honcho in charge, stand on all of this? And we don't know. And
it's but it might become less and less relevant because events are bypassing him.
And this is what I think is the key thing. It's less and less relevant. One of the interesting lines within that Gazeta piece was that by allowing a kind of harsh sentence mm-hmm. against Navalny, the presidential administration has lost a lever of influence over the Siloviki.
I agree with you. That was one of the most important lines in that piece.
And that is really, really interesting, because it kind of creates a semblance of a kind of inversion of power. If the presidential administration can't lever against this kind of hardline faction, whoever it is, and this certainly changes the dynamics of politics and who's really running the show and who is exercising power and influence over the system.
Kirill, what do you think? Is there a collective Navalny developing? I mean, I haven't done a lot on his team. That'd be a good subject for a podcast, actually. Do you see a collective Navalny developing? And if you're Navalny, what do you think the strategy should be right now?
I think the most important thing to do, and that's of course not an advice for Navalny, even for Putin himself and so on, is to set up a different, absolutely different agenda.
Which he's doing.
To define it, yes. And to define it, that's very important. To explain this agenda to the society. Because why all these heroes of the previous period of Russian history, including, you know, this Nemtsov and so on, why they're disappearing from the public interest and so on? Because their previous agenda was absolutely different. And that's why, you know, opposition movement was so, you know, narrow in social meaning of this word. Because that was a struggle of, you know, pro-democracy or liberal forces against anti-liberal and authoritarian regime. That is very important. I agree with this, you know, struggle personally. But that was not such interesting for the whole Russian society. And all of us, we understand why. Now it's absolutely a different time. That's not a time of, you know, liberals against, you know, authoritarians, because we cannot even define Navalny as a liberal, yeah, as a pro-democracy leader. We don't know. We know absolutely nothing about his political.
It depends what you mean by liberal. If you mean somebody that advocates a multi-party democracy and separation of, you know, yes, he's a liberal. If you get into questions of his soft liberal nationalism, or so, as it's been called, then no, he wouldn't be liberal. He'd probably be right of center in any Western system.
Soft liberal nationalism is like, you know, soft.
I mean, it depends.
Soft vodka, yeah?
It depends what context you put him in, right? But
yeah, but if you don't know, you know, nothing, but we know, you know, a very few things about his political views. I agree. Okay, but the most important thing now, that new agenda is a real, reliable, you know, accountable politics against absolutely apolitical, pragmatic measures by Kremlin. And I think that Russian society is beginning to understand that it needs, you know, a real accountable politics about every, you know, feature of its life. Doesn't matter from what point of view, communist, liberal, doesn't matter. But there are a lot of very serious, very, you know, dangerous problems in Russian societies, from, you know, this education academy scandal and so on, to the economy, you know, forthcoming economic crisis and whatever. And they need people who, you know, focus on these things, on not on, you know, these intrigues, not all the funny, you know, the
Putin going down in a submarine, which I thought was just
yes,
a brilliant metaphor,
yes,
actually.
Yes, absolutely.
As this Navalny down, thing yes. was going on, did we see Putin? Where did we see him? We saw him doing his old act.
Yes.
But he was in a submarine. The images were in a submarine submerging into the water. I mean, Surikov would never have allowed that. I know I keep singing the guy's praises, but I mean, really, that would never have happened in the middle of this when Surikov was running the political show in the Kremlin. Think about it.
That's why I'm speaking about the decline of professionalism in all, you know, in all the fields of, governmental activity and so on. And since I just returned from Russia, and I participated in some conference, semi-academic concert, conference which took place on the famous Strelka, you know, this... place in Moscow, which is a special menagerie for hipsters, mm-hmm, yes, mm-hmm, in the city. And one of the participators of the in the conference was the Moscow government, and they sent several bureaucrats to flirt with the liberal hipsters and academics and so on. And this was so unprofessional. That was so clumsy. They couldn't speak in this, absolutely normal, not academic jargon, but mm-hmm, just a normal language. That they, they prefer to disappear in several minutes from this.
I'm sure you're familiar, Kirill, with, and Sean, you probably are too, with the famous incident where Sobyanin decided to meet the young people in the Jean-Jacques Cafe. But in order to do so, they had to clear out the entire place. So the patrons, the very people he was supposed to be appealing to, were excluded from this. And supposedly they brought some special throne-like chair into the Jean-Jacques that was all over the blogs. So yeah, they've been incredibly clumsy at trying to appeal to this segment of society. I think it's really telling that they feel the need to. One thing I wanted to go to is assessing the public's reaction on this so far, because I've heard different opinions about what happened yesterday. And the people that want to dismiss it say, it was only 5,000 people. Actually, it was a very hard crowd to count. I mean, I was watching a live feed of this throughout the night, and it was all over the place. It wasn't like people concentrated in one square where you can get a good head count. The opposition says 10,000. The police said 2,500. Journalists tended to split the difference and give it 5. I don't think it mattered, for a couple of reasons that I'll say. Number one, it wasn't the crowd, it was the intensity. I mean, for God's sakes, they were climbing on the ledge of the Duma. It looked almost like an Occupy situation for a minute, for more than a minute there. That's number one. There was the intensity. There was their bravery. I mean, the police presence on the streets yesterday was unbelievable, and they went out anyway. So I'd say 5,000, that's a big 2,500, that's a big number of people to brave that kind of police presence that was on the streets, especially in Moscow. Number three, and I learned this from our colleagues in our Tatar Bashkir service reporting out of Kazan yesterday, that people that went out, there's a small demonstration in Kazan, but there were people that never went out before. And they did a story about this, about how people that never went out before went out for Navalny. This is one man that got all these people on the streets. So I think when we're talking about it's really, really a mistake to focus on the numbers. It's the intensity, and it's the willingness to go out knowing what's waiting for you out there. And then the numbers look a little bit different. Mark, what's your take on the public reaction and how this might develop?
Yeah, the interesting point for me, and actually sort of going back to what Kirill was saying about the issue of competence, is precisely, I think, at the moment we are seeing two, from the Kremlin's point of view, very dangerous phenomena. One is Navalny increasingly elevated to this symbol. I mean, let's be honest, it's not so much the guy himself, it's what he represents. You know, he is the man who the authorities keep trying to nail. He's the man who keeps on raising corruption issues within the government and so forth, and the man who basically gets the Kremlin to back down. So symbolically, he's incredibly powerful. But secondly, the regime itself is looking increasingly incompetent on so many levels. I mean, one can look at the sort of the specifics of particular policies. One can look at the handling of this whole Navalny case. But one can also look at everything from Sochi downwards.
He looks like a chess player in a room full of checkers players right now.
and this is a regime that really, however much it's relied also on Putin's personality cult, on a bit of nationalism and so forth, has basically legitimized itself on technocratic basis. It's more or less said, look, you just keep out of politics. You know, genuflect when mm-hmm. needed in elections, but essentially assume that going back to Sean's, it's sort of the self-onocracy know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, they're going to enrich themselves, but meanwhile, your life is going to get better. And, in the first Putin eras, thank courtesy of oil and gas, that mm-hmm. happened. But increasingly, actually, there's a government that really doesn't stand for anything except its own self-interest and can't even do its own job. Now, I think the one does not necessarily lead to the other. The real issue for me is that you have both of these rising. You've got an alternative figure rising who embodies in his own way a different way of doing things, precisely multi-party democracy, accountability, all that kind of thing, and a current system which is manifestly failing.
It's like the past looking to the future. I mean, it's just I can't get over this. The generational thing in so many ways, this is really... There are so many metaphors from Russia. We've used the Yeltsin one from the past. But this is even different from that.
But also it's dangerous. I mean, yes, there is clearly a generational dimension. But there's a danger in making that because actually if you look at people who are protesting, and particularly as the people who are newly protesting, they're not 24-year-old hipsters with iPhones.
But it's a new generation of leaders. And what's significant here with Navalny, besides his obvious intelligence and obvious charisma, is that you have somebody, as I said before, who came of age politically after the Soviet collapse. This is the first real figure that has come of age after the Soviet collapse. And you have somebody, more importantly, I think, who came from outside of the system. Right. I actually did a little thought experiment today. Who was the last Russian leader to come from outside the system? It was Lenin.
It was Lenin.
Yeah.
A lawyer. No, I'm not saying Navalny is Lenin. And he was quite successful. He was quite successful. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, he really didn't have a lot of people coming on the streets for him initially. Right. Sean, do you see the people that are willing to come out from Navalny growing, or do you?
Well, I think what you said is absolutely correct. Like the numbers aren't really that important. It's the energy, and I would like to point out that this was an unsanctioned rally.
Yes, that's yeah.
I mean, you know, in my kind of musings about political protest, one of the things that I always find interesting is how people who protest work with the state to get permission to have a rally.
Yeah.
It kind of undermines the whole. Well, it doesn't completely undermine protest, but it undermines some of it. But this was a case where they came out. Regardless of what the state thought, and the state allowed it, because if they didn't, it would have been it would have been awful. The levels of violence would have been really, really, it would have been bad. So it's good. At least they were smart enough to allow it to happen within some kind of controllable bounds. But the fact that people came out without as an unsanctioned in an unsanctioned rally shows, and all over in all the places around the country where there are rallies, shows. The real power of crowds of people, right? It puts power in their on their
25 cities by my count.
Yeah, I mean this is extraordinary, and as Mark says repeatedly, that Navalny as a symbol is really really important, and this that so many people would come out for this symbol. However, I completely agree with Kirill that there is a thirst in Russia for real politics. There's a thirst for social economic politics. In my conversations with people, with academics in Russia, the main problem they had with the opposition is they have no social economic agenda. The human rights lawyer, in the two conversations I had, one with the human rights lawyer, he was really, really strong on this, that, you know, the opposition cares about human rights and democracy, which is all fine. I mean, this is what he does for a living. But at the same time, they're not addressing the issues that most Russians care about. One of the issues that I found really, really striking is how expensive it is to live in that country. Mm-hmm. It's unbelievable how much things cost. I couldn't – it was striking. It was incredibly striking. I don't know how anyone can eke out a decent living in that country,
no,
considering how expensive things
are. Along those lines, though, one of the things that was lost in all of this Navalny stuff that's been going on is the man did put out a very, very detailed platform, He released a video that I don't know if any of you saw it, but it was extremely slick, where it was very Western style, and that he had different people in the room illustrating, you know, this is Yulia and she's trying to, I can't think of all the examples he used, and you know, he had a bunch of people behind, they're all his supporters obviously, each one of them to illustrate a certain problem in the city, and this is how we're going to address it. And he is answering that. He has put forward an actual program to run. The Moscow mayoral election isn't just some vanity project here. I don't think he expects to win it, but he
you're
is
right.
Put
You're right. I read an article in Sloan about that that basically said that there was hardly any difference between his platform and Subianin's.
Yes.
So if you're going to choose a political leader, you got to choose the guy that has the connections within the system to get things done, or you got to choose the guy that's on the outside and he has some great ideas, but there's really no difference than the guy in power. So,
well, I must admit, I have not read Subianin's electoral platform. I'm embarrassed to admit.
doesn't this bring up in some ways that there are two Navalny's? I mean, there is Navalny, a politician who has programs and has ideas and so forth. And then there is Navalny, the mythic figure, who is there for everyone to put their own particular interests and sort of passions on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that. And both of these things are developing and growing and getting stronger by the day. And the Kremlin keeps giving him these gifts. I mean, I don't know if you saw the images of when he, you know, those images of him hugging his wife as he was released today. Those were powerful. His statement where he almost teared up as he was thanking the people for coming out on the streets with him. This is powerful stuff. This is the stuff of which leaders are made. And I'm wondering, and I've been reluctant to say this on the podcast or even write it, but I can't help but wonder if we're not looking at Russia's next leader. I mean, really. I mean, it's becoming increasingly obvious that he's moving in that direction. I don't know if we're going there. I'm not going to make any predictions, but I just don't see anybody else on the horizon that has these kinds of assets and is exploiting them, and who the Kremlin keeps, you think they're working for him, keeps giving him opportunities one after another. I mean, he could shoot so many campaign commercials over the events of the last 2 weeks. I mean, really. I mean, it's amazing. We're kind of wrapping up on the first half, and I want to move into the second half. But are there any thoughts anybody has before we move on? We're kind of in free form today.
One thought, from another conversation I've had, if you guys are interested in hearing this, was I asked one professor if the liberals of Russia today, the opposition, takes any historical lessons from the Tsarist past. And he said, and I was surprised by this, no. And I found this, and it came up again, that the fact that even the cadets of the 19th century had a social program mm-hmm. that was almost mildly socialist. And I really think that in this period of kind of a lot is happening, there is value for the opposition to recognize that it does have a historical legacy, not just a legacy the Sakharov and late perestroika in the Soviet system, but has a longer legacy that goes back. And I think there's some great historical lessons that they can take from the past.
And I would point out, to give you kudos, Sean, you, on your very first appearance on the Power Vertical podcast, you said that the late 19th century, the late Tsarist period, was the most applicable parallel to today. And I'm not going to let Kirill get in here because he hates historical parallels. So I'm turning off your microphone. I'm pulling a Bill O'Reilly. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion on the aftermath of the Navalny verdict since, well, there really isn't anything else to discuss today. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me in Prague is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Joining us from London is co-host Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service and a contributor to the online magazine Politru. And joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. I would also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfurl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
If anyone hopes that Alexei's investigations will stop, it's not going to happen. His anti-corruption foundation will continue its work. We very much hope for your support. The most important thing we can do now is continue working and show solidarity with Pyotr and Alexei.
That, of course, was Alexei Navalny's wife, Yulia Navalnaya, speaking outside the courtroom yesterday, pledging that her husband's anti-corruption work would go on even if he remained in prison. He, of course, has not remained in prison, but he may end up back there pretty soon once his appeals are exhausted. Sean, what do you think? And this gets into the discussion of the collective Navalny we were talking about in the first half of the a little bit in the first. Can the virtual Navalny carry on if, in fact, the authorities put the real Navalny behind bars?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this is a real test. And tragic circumstances sometimes provide opportunities. And I think this is one for the Navalny machine or the collective Navalny to develop itself and develop a more visible infrastructure, develop other leaders and other political figures. I mean, Russia is a very large country. And while Moscow is certainly the most important city, there's a lot of territory to gain. And here, I think Navalny creates a different center of the opposition. I think I agree with you that to speak of the opposition is almost, you know, not worth
passé.
It anymore. It's passé. It's only really about him. He's the most visible, the most effective, and the most vocal figure. But he's also a figure that's going to prison, mm-hmm. most likely. So I do think that this is an opportunity for the people around him that we don't know. We don't know their names. We don't know their faces. To really, with him, this symbol in prison, to really use the opportunity to develop a structure around him to carry on his corrupt anti-corruption activities and also political activities to start bringing up new fresh faces from behind the scenes. And this goes to something that I said last time I was on the podcast. I do think that there is a great danger in political movements that coalesce around one person. On the one hand, they stifle small-d democracy within that movement. You don't get a lot of fat players. One person becomes really powerful in the center of it. And also, because if you have one person at the center, they could easily be decapitated and the movement can go into disarray and lose its momentum and lose its effectiveness. And I think that though this situation is tragic, that Navalny will most likely end up in prison possibly for 5 years, possibly for longer since they have a couple other cases against him, this is really a watershed moment. If there is a watershed, mm-hmm. this is a watershed moment because this is going to be a main test of what the people around him in particular, but the opposition in general, and how they move forward.
I do think I see a theme for a future podcast, gentlemen, because this is something that we can explore. And actually, there was an excellent article. I think it's the best thing I've read in English, at least, and perhaps in English or in Russian, on Navalny. An article by Julia Yoffe in the latest New Republic. I tweeted it today. It's called "The Most Dangerous Blogger in the World: How Alexei Navalny Changed Russian Politics." And in this piece, she did get into this a little bit about things he was doing before we knew who he was, right? And he was doing what we would call in the West community organizing, basically, in Moscow. He was helping people, young people, kind of organize to whatever, fix some local problem in their apartment block or something. And this is where he began to get his first kind of group of supporters. Then he moved on to Rospil and his anti-corruption blog, and later the Fund to Fight Corruption, where he began to outsource this. So there is a team there. It's just it's our job as now right now I have to say I'm deficient in this right now. It's our job as Russia watchers to learn a little bit about this, because there is a team there. I see similar faces with him all the time that are around him. But I don't want to call it a collective Navalny, because I don't want to draw a parallel with him and Putin, because we always use the term collective Putin. But there is a team there, and it's worthwhile to see. And this team is about to be tested. Mark, what do you think? Do you see this? If Navalny does end up behind bars, can the Navalny team carry on his work and keep this going?
A stint in prison is a time-honored characteristic of any sort of good opposition leader turned national leader's CV, and it has a certain value. It means that you trade practical political impact for moral authority, and it also means in some ways that you are taken out of the messy day-to-day politics. And what tends to happen, again, the classic trajectory is precisely that things get worse while you're in prison. Because you aren't directly sort of connected, you become the authority figure who can then be released and then can bring the country together. I mean, Nelson Mandela is a classic example. Yeah. I think we'll just be a bit cautious with that.
I'm cautious with it, but I can't help but keep thinking about it.
How far, Robben Island was the making of the Nelson Mandela myth and therefore his mm-hmm. authority afterwards is an important one. So, I mean, on the one level, I wouldn't want to wish prison, especially a Russian prison, on anyone. But if we're thinking of it in very sort of dispassionate sort of grand mm-hmm. political terms, it can be useful. But yeah, it very much depends on what's there. And again, most of these leaders do have parties, machines, guerrilla armies or whatever that they leave behind that have hierarchies.
Doesn't Navalny have the 21st century equivalent of that with his with this virtual network he's built up, everything from the young people that support him from his time community organizing to Ross Pill to the fund to fight corruption to the nearly 400,000 followers he has on Twitter.
This is not a machine. I think this is the thing. This
it's
is
the makings
this is a,
of one.
Exactly. This is a huge box full of gears and cogs. But no one yet has actually been putting the
kit cogs together. Yeah.
Now that I think is going to be and something that you know I think we've all been saying sort of for a while. I mean that is going to be one of the biggest challenges. So I mean I think sort of it could be the making of Navalny, mm-hmm. but very much it will therefore put the emphasis on this. What up to now has been a support team. He's got a team, yes, but anyway, the team is there to allow Navalny to do his thing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, now we'll have to see actually how they can operate without necessarily sort of the central figure.
Kirill, your thoughts?
I agree with Mark in his, skepticism about this.
I'm not sure he was skeptical.
Yes, yes.
Slightly cautious.
Bit, yes.
Cautious, I would
okay,
say.
Okay.
I play optimist.
Okay, a bunch of online activists are not a political party, of course. And they couldn't be.
But it's more than online activists. This is, I think we have to be careful with our terminology here. It's not just online activists. They're actively investigating corruption and posting the evidence online. It's not just a bunch of dudes sitting in their pajamas, blogging and writing their latest musings about what's going on in Russia. They are actually doing investigative journalism and before that there was the community organizing. So I think it's more than that.
And also I just have to say also when they're doing their corruption investigation, they clearly have links to people with information.
Yes, they're outsourcing very aggressively.
They seem to be connected to people of some sort of power too.
Well, that's another thing that's worth exploring too.
Yeah. To fight with corruption, it's a very noble thing, but it doesn't mean that you are involved in some political positive political activity. That is the difference between critical attitude to this regime and to the corruption and so on, and some positive values. Political activity basically begins from political values. It's the question of values. Fight with corruption is not a value, in itself. It's a very good thing, but it must be connected to something. This is my first point. The second point that, of course, online activity is very effective, and it was very effective. Just, have in mind the speed with which, all the supporters of Navalny gathered in Moscow just in 2 or 3 hours after the verdict. But we're speaking about the country where people usually go online to, for shopping, to watch some porn, and to watch some YouTube funny videos. And it's not all...
Sounds like any country.
Yes. No. In Russia, it's much more serious than in other countries. Just trust me. Yeah. And this is a very important thing. The step from, online politics to, real politics. If you go outside Moscow or some big cities, you will see this difference. And if you want to be a real politician and to fight on political scene, you must have in mind all these people who lived, outside Moscow, St. Petersburg, Nizhny Novgorod, and so on. And moreover,
people came out in 25 cities yesterday. People came out in 25 cities across Russia.
And the third point, it's connected with that what you are saying. For instance, in my native Nizhny Novgorod, there was a sort of, meeting or sort of protest. It gathered 150 people. But the main question was they were against a local mayor. Just several mentions of Navalny's name, but the main thing was that they need to a local mayor to be ousted, to resign. So,
but they just happened to come out right after Navalny was sentenced to prison?
Yes. They just connected two things, and that's very important, to connect the mm-hmm. Navalny case with local politics. And just these three reasons for a new, different agenda, which I was speaking about. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, one of the other things that struck me, and this touches on this nexus between the online politics and the real politics, if you will. And this is another point Julia Yoffe made in her what I thought was an excellent article in The New Republic. She said that Navalny's teaching people not to be afraid. He's teaching people not to be afraid. He's teaching people that you can oppose this regime and go on living, so to speak. And I think that cannot be underestimated. We began this with this segment with a quote from Yulia Navalny speaking outside of the court, and we really haven't heard much from Yulia Navalny until now. We've seen her at his side throughout a lot of this, but in fact, before yesterday, the only time I had heard her speak was an interview she gave to Dosh TV back in April when the trial was starting, where she came off as pretty smart, pretty funny, and I must say, very likable. Let's listen to a clip from that interview where she was asked if she ever told her husband to stop, to ease up, to tone it down a bit. Let's listen to what Yulia Navalny had to say there.
I think many people expect me to tell him to stop at some point. No, I have never said anything like that to my husband. And it's the absolute truth, because I sincerely believe that he's doing it not for himself, but for my children and all the people. He wants to make life better.
You have to wonder, and this thought also came into my mind yesterday when I thought Navalny was going away for 5 years. And I think we all thought Navalny was going away for 5 years yesterday. And what I was wondering is, with him incarcerated, will his wife Yulia take a more active public role right now? I mean, I understand she was running his Twitter feed back when he spent 15 days in detention after the protests. Mark, what do you see happening here? This is an interesting question, an interesting unexplored question. She's certainly a very, very impressive woman based on the very little I have to go on right now. But I've certainly been impressed by what little I've said. Like I said, she comes across very smart, very, very funny, likable. Do you see a public figure in the making here as well?
I mean, I think it's an interesting question. It's an obvious one. And in some ways, this speaks very much to what Sean was saying earlier, actually, about the democratic limitations of any political movement built around one human being. Because one could just as easily say, well, why should being a spouse be a suitable sort of basis for being a representative or a successor?
Because I get the impression she's not just she's his spouse, of course, but she also appears to be very engaged in his activities.
Sure.
That appears to be the case. I don't, again, there's very little we know right now.
We do. I mean, this is a woman who doesn't even have a Wikipedia page, which in this day and age is quite a striking thing for anyone who's been in the public eye.
I don't have a Wikipedia page.
Yeah, but, you know, we'll all hesitate to go and draw the obvious comparisons. But I think, again, for me, the issue is not whether or not she's smart and engaged and so forth. I'm sure she's all of those things. It's that in some ways I think it would be a wrong turning. Mm-hmm. This is an opportunity precisely to turn a one-man band into a genuine political movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying it would be impossible for her to do so. But it just simply becomes that sort of, well, you know, Yulia is Alexei's vicar on earth. But her role is precisely just simply to be Alexei Navalny's representative.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to see a movement arise in which there can be other people who have their own, obviously, you know, they're within a movement in which Navalny heads, but precisely they have their own perspectives, they have their own weight, they have their own impact.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the key problems of the Putin regime has precisely been how Putinistic, how centralized on one person it is. It might well speak to all kinds of sort of suitable loamy Russian memes to have a sort of a pretender czar coming to defeat the existing czar. But I think, again, if we're talking about this as being a process in which actually democracy is in the making, we need to see a movement arise. And if from that process Yulia emerges as one of the leaders because she has the ideas, because she has the support and so forth, that's great, but it should come from below rather than anointment from above.
And I probably should add, she doesn't appear to be interested in play. I mean, from what little I have to go on, and I was watching the Dosht interview, but there was the point where the interview asked her, you know, Alexei said he does want to be president. Do you see yourself as first lady? And her answer was very, very telling. She said, I can definitely see Alexei as president, but I do not see myself as First Lady. So it was a very modest, a very sincere, and almost touching moment in the interview. Sean, what are your thoughts on this?
I mean, in the last couple of weeks, we have been seeing her more and more photographed. She's been present. And a lot of this is because she's his wife. I mean, to portray him as having a family, as having a circle outside of him, you know, children.
There's two children, one 5 years old, one 11.
It's really, really important to show that he's a regular guy, that he, you know, has this family behind him. Part of me thinks it's somewhat natural that if she steps into maybe not a leadership role, but certainly an important node in the wider Navalny circle, because as his wife, she has intimate connection with him. She probably has, once he's in prison, I don't know how this works in Russia, but I would imagine that she has far more access to him than, say, others.
Yeah, I would imagine, yeah.
So it's natural that she becomes an important figure while Alexei Navalny is in prison. I agree with Mark. There needs to be more around her, but I think we should also remember, since Brian, you're the one who brought up Lenin, that Lenin's wife, Nadezhda Krupskaya, was a political force in and of herself, mm-hmm. and she had her own political agendas going on too. Mm-hmm. Granted, I see Kirill's in her shaking his head, but nonetheless, she was a political figure, and as well as the people, Lenin's sisters were helping him in his political struggle too. Mm-hmm. So I think that family does play an important role. The question is what role will she carve out, mm-hmm. if she's interested? While Alexei Navalny is in prison.
Kirill, what are your thoughts on this?
I wouldn't recommend Yulia Navalny and Navalny himself to play this little bit, you know, archaic Bollywood-style Indian political game with the family political game, like, you know, Jawaharlal Nehru, then Indira Gandhi, then Rajiv Gandhi, then Sonia Gandhi.
I'm not suggesting that. I'm suggesting that that we will see a larger public profile of her if he is incarcerated. We will. We definitely will.
You know, it will end up as, you know, Navalny Montecchi against Putin Capuletti. It's not a personal struggle. It's not a personal issue. That would be a very grave mistake, even just to play personally against Putin. Navalny as a political or as a would-be political leader is not about personal hate against Putin, and it's not all about, you know, a personal fate of Navalny himself and his wife and so on. Of course, she looks great, yes, in all senses, but anyway, she had three options now. She could play, you know, a spouse of political prisoner. She could play a political leader as, you know...
Surrogate.
Yes. And he could be in a, you know, sort of shadows.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the best way will be the third.
Mm. You play in the shadows?
Yes.
Mark,
yes.
What do you think?
I don't... Again, I think sort of obviously we're layering supposition on supposition,
yeah,
since we know so little about her. I mean, I certainly would agree with Sean that she will play some role naturally, just simply as a link person. But, you know, she'll be more than just a courier. Mm-hmm. She also helps anchor Navalny precisely as a real human being. And it's quite interesting that sort of we have the Navalny wholesome family life set against Putin divorce.
Right,
rumor.
I was just going to say that. Yeah, yeah. And when everybody in the country knew that they'd been barely on speaking terms. But.
I think, you know, we're definitely going to be seeing him within the campaign. I suppose my concern is precisely whether it's whether it comes from Navalny or whether it comes from people within the circle, who precisely because it's what they're familiar with, push for her to become this figurehead,
mm-hmm.
And in the process lose this opportunity to make it a chance to create a broader coalition. Mm-hmm.
I don't think those things are mutually exclusive, to be honest. I don't think those things are mutually exclusive at all. But I certainly do think we have to look at this, the Navalny team, and how is it going to function without Navalny himself is certainly something we're going to want to take a look at in the future. This story is fluid and moving fast. In fact, I'm afraid there's going to be another development before I even get out of the studio. But unfortunately, that is all we have time for today. I would like to remind you that you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RVRL. In the studio with me in Prague has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us from London has been co-host Kirill Kobrin of RVRL's Russian service and a contributor to the online magazine Politru. And also joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Thanks for the great discussion, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I would also like to thank our producer, Pavel Balak, who is still filling in for Tanya Koncheva, who is still on a beach in Croatia, still enjoying a much-deserved vacation from me. I'd also like to thank my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.